Today is Saturday. It's our second day of retreat here. It's also our last day of retreat. Depends how we look at it, according to relative terms. So I say good morning, but it's not actually morning because it's after 12. But it's morning somewhere else. On Saturday in Israel, even if they are at war, Saturday is the Sabbath, and Sunday is the equivalent of Monday for us. So this day is just this for us right here now, although we say it's our second day or our last day, depending on how we look at it. In French, when you say seconde, the equivalent of second in English, it actually means that there is not anything after it. So if you said seconde jour, there would not be a third day. But if you said deuxième, then there would be a day after it. So they have that subtlety in French. I don't know if that similar thing in Portuguese. In English, we don't have that. But English is far less subtle than French in a lot of ways. So is this the second day or is this the second day? In any case, we think of it, we know that tomorrow we will leave, as we said in the meeting. In a sense, we're already projecting towards tomorrow. As I often do when we talk about that, moving to out of the retreat, I cite my teacher's teacher who said, if you don't want to leave the Zendo, don't enter it. So if you don't want to leave the meditation hall, don't go in the meditation hall. He didn't mean don't go in the meditation hall. He meant don't make the difference, this huge difference between the retreat and the not retreat. Don't make the huge difference between your life out there and your life here. The difference between your practice and your life, or your life and your practice. So when we project to, okay, what will we do tomorrow? We will go. Often we have activities that we know await us, whether it's work, family, leisure, we may have plans to go to the cinema with someone tomorrow night, have dinner with people, and then Monday morning, work, study, whatever awaits us. Right? So we're already projecting ahead. Actually, those are just other activities. It's just other aspects of the moment that arises. And by coming to a retreat, we say we practice just being with what is here right now, just paying attention to this. As I said in the beginning, you don't have to use your clocks here because the timekeeper does it for you. So you really only have to respond to what arises. So we sit here, they say Dharma talk, everybody moves, takes seats, the bell rings, we chant, then it stops, then you wait till I start talking, and then you listen, and you just respond to what is happening at this moment. It seems very easy in a retreat, even though it's hard. But we can think that it's easier because, oh yeah, I don't have all this activity of my daily life that I have to tend to. I don't have to cook here. I don't have to do any shopping. I don't have to do cleaning except my task. So, you know, Sophia's cleaning lots of toilets, and the other people too, so we don't have to. But she doesn't have to clean the kitchen. Somebody else does it. Whereas at home, we have to clean the toilets, we have to clean the kitchen, we have to do shopping, we have to do cooking, or we have to pay somebody to do it, whatever our activities are. So here, it's simplified. Actually, the truth is that we can do the same thing when we leave the meditation hall, get in the car or on the train, and go into our daily lives. We can approach it in the same way. One of the famous stories that I used to talk about all the time, I've kind of stopped for a while doing that, probably for 10 years now almost, but I used to talk about James Joyce's Ulysses, which is this great work of English literature, Irish, but in English literature, where it's basically the story of a guy who leaves his house in the morning, makes his way, wanders around Dublin, does all kinds of things until midnight when he comes back home. So he leaves home, he walks around, does all kinds of stuff, and then comes back home. And you say, how could somebody write a book that's like this thick and this legendary, mythic work of literature that's just about some guy named Bloom who's walking around Dublin? It sounds really outrageous, right? And actually, it's modeled on Homer's great work, The Odyssey. So it's basically a modern retelling of The Odyssey. So you think, well, how could, you know, Homer, this great work of world literature, be about some guy who goes out and then comes home? But actually, Ulysses in The Odyssey, he goes off to fight a war. He goes off to fight the Trojan War. And his way home is full of all kinds of obstacles and delays and detours. It takes him years to come back home, and when he comes home, nobody recognizes him, except the dog. So how can those be great works of literature? Because they're the story of our life. You know, they really are. And Bloom, for me, Joyce's Ulysses is a great Buddhist work. It's the way of the bodhisattva, because Bloom, the main character, is a bodhisattva. He leaves his house in the morning so that his wife can receive her lover when, and he won't be there. She doesn't know that's what he's doing. It's kind of an unspoken thing that's going on. But, and he goes out for the whole day, and he's looking for this other guy who's a young man who has lost his father, or his father's worthless degenerate, and Bloom is trying to help this young man, Stephen, who is also wandering around Dublin, and eventually they will meet, and they meet with this key moment where Bloom fully manifests the bodhisattva by helping, saving Stephen from, he's been in a brothel, he's drunk, he's been abandoned by his friends, whatever, and Bloom saves him. A great act of a bodhisattva. So what does that have to do with us? Because that's the story of our life too. We go out, we leave our home, we leave our zendo, and we go out in the world, and we respond to the situations. So Bloom goes out there and meets all kinds of people, and the episodes correspond to episodes in the Odyssey. But all he's doing is responding to situations. And that's all that we, that's what our life is, responding to situations. Responding to people, circumstances, situations. How can we best do that? Well, then that is the trick, right? So that's what we come here to do, is to, so we can settle down and not be distracted by our ideas about what we should do and respond appropriately to whatever it is that arises. It sounds simple when we hear it, when I say this like this, but it's not, as we all know. And it can be anything from, you know, should I change jobs, to how can I repair the relationship with my partner? Should I repair the relationship with my partner? My mother is really angry at me. What can I do about that? My father's lonely. Any number of things, right? It can be, should I buy a new car or not? All kinds of things that we encounter in our daily life. And if we can settle down with our meditation practice, we're better equipped to meet those moments in everyday life. And the more we do it and the more we deepen our practice, the more we see that, like my teacher's teacher said, we're not actually leaving the Zendo and going into the world. We're just moving into a different room, a different space, a different moment. And we have this, so we have Bloom, who represents this in the literary world. Although for me, like I said, this is a deeply Buddhist book, and I used to give workshops on it, and we used to do in Paris, we did a study group, online we did, on my old blog we had a study group, I did a workshop at the Village Zendo in New York, because it's a deeply Buddhist person, it's a way of bridging our contemporary literature with ancient teachings. Well, in the ancient teachings of Buddhism, we also have a character like this, who you may have seen is very popular, like in Chinese restaurants. You know, you see this fat Buddha there who's laughing. Sometimes they have a statue of the fat laughing Buddha. And sometimes people think that it's actually a representation of the Buddha, but it's not. It's actually someone who exists whose name was Hotai. That's the Japanese name. And sometimes we call him the Laughing Buddha. But he was actually a Zen master and a wandering Zen master. He didn't have a temple, which was traditional, would be to have a temple. And this was the 8th or 9th century China, the golden age of Zen. And it was traditional to have a temple or live in a monastery, something like that. And he did not. He was wandering. So I can identify with him to a certain extent of not having a temple, not having a fixed, I say, architecture, wandering. Of course, I do have a house that I live in and a family. I'm not wandering like Hotai was, but our Sangha is kind of an itinerant Sangha, much like the Buddhist Sangha, where we settle where we're invited to settle. Actually, we invite ourselves, but we settle where the doors are open for us to settle, let's say. So in that sense, I can identify with Hotai, not wanting to be in one spot. Although Hotai also has this particularity of he's carrying this huge bag over his shoulder. And it's full of all kinds of things that generally in the stories, he stops and he plays with children. He has all these things in his bag that he takes out and invites children to play, and it's always very funny and playful. So those are just the basic outline of who he is. Sometimes then when we start looking into it and we say his bag represents emptiness, but a way of, we could say that emptiness is fullness, actually. His bag is full of anything that he might need to meet the moment. And Bernie Glassman used to use this, one of my teachers used to use this as an example, as a symbol of, so how do we respond to a situation? If we only have a screwdriver in our bag, meaning if we have a fixed idea about what we will need, and we arrive at a situation and we need a hammer, or a knife, or a fork, or a feather, and we only have a screwdriver, well, we have a hard time responding to the situation. Actually, we do that a lot, though, right? We come to a situation, we have this idea about what we need, what needs to be done, what we should say, what we should not say, and we mess things up often when we do that. Or we create suffering for ourselves. Like, I give the example of, I used to hate separation, like leaving people, leaving situations, moving, or leaving my family or something. So what I did was, because I only had a screwdriver, I didn't know how to deal with that situation, I just left. I didn't say goodbye. I avoided saying goodbye. I figured it out some way so that the last time I was seeing them, it wasn't really the last time, and so I just left. And it was terrible. It was very painful. This was really painful to not say goodbye to people, but I had the idea that it would be more painful to say goodbye. And it was painful for the people who I wasn't saying goodbye to, because it was kind of, wait, where did Amy go? You know? My screwdriver was, I can't say goodbye, I have to leave. We can find thousands, millions of examples of behaving like this in our lives, right? So Hotai has a bag that's full. You say it's empty, but it's actually full, because it's the same thing, empty and full. And so I wrote down this little koan in which Hotai figures. I only took part of it. It's longer, actually, but one story in which Hotai figures. So, Hotai is, you know, hanging out in the marketplace, we say. The marketplace in traditional society, well, even, you know, even in most cultures, you know, marketplace is a central place where everybody gathers and does transactions and meets each other, and all the activities of the worldly world take place in the marketplace. And so Hotai was often found in a marketplace somewhere in some town or village, playing with the children, entertaining, right, with stuff from his bag. So in this story, he's at a marketplace somewhere, and another Zen master arrives and asks him, what is the meaning of Zen? Okay, classic thing. You know. What's the meaning of Zen? Hotai immediately put his sack down on the ground. So he's got this big sack and he puts it down. Then, said the other one, what's the actualization of Zen? So the meaning of Zen is putting the bag down. Well, what's the actualization? Is that word clear for you in Portuguese? I don't know.
Can you repeat?
Development.
I think we're clear. Good.
You got a good idea. Yeah. You know, it's a traditional Zen thing that is really hard to grasp. But as long as you understand the meaning of it, yeah, okay. The word's meaning. Yeah. So he says, so if that's the significance or the meaning of it, putting it down, what's the actualization of Zen? At once, Hotai swung the sack over his shoulder and continued on his way. So, that's the story. The meaning of Zen is to put it down, and the actualization of it is to pick it up and continue on your way, Hotai is saying. Why am I telling you this story? What does this mean for us? In a sense, can we see the putting it down like, well, different ways, you know. Okay, so we come here and we sit and we're putting it down. We are putting it down could be letting go, so dropping it. So putting down this, so I'm not going to look at the words anymore, I'm just going to talk. Putting it down. I'm not going to hang on to what I have to know the exact words, I have to know the exact story, I have to have this little paper that I can hold, right? Put it down. Put down, we can see also, put down my ideas about a situation. Put down my concepts, put down my ideas about myself. What does that mean to put down concepts? Hotai, he puts down even the concept of having a bag of tools. He just puts it down. He says that's the meaning of Zen. The great Zen master who wasn't a Zen master, Alan Watts, gave this great interpretation of the immaculate conception, which you've heard me talk about before, some of you. Is it relatively the same thing in Portuguese? Immaculate conception. And concept works with conception in Portuguese?
Yes.
Okay. So Alan Watts said, and this is actually quite a deep realization, I find, but we would be burned at the stake by the Catholic Church if we said this, actually. So we're saying it here, and please beg for forgiveness, but... So he said the Immaculate Conception is exactly that. It means to be absolutely free of concepts. That Christ represented that. Free of concepts. Immaculate is like clean,
pure.
No concepts. All concepts put down. If we look at it in the Christian context, so Christ arose from this Immaculate Conception where there are no concepts. Any concept of Christ is moving away from what Christ said and did and lived and manifested. And then we know what happened after that. You know, well, he was burned, I mean, he was crucified for that. And then Church was built around concepts, unfortunately. Not that the church is all bad, but that's as soon as we start having concepts, we build churches, we build temples, we build monasteries, we build synagogues, we build ashrams, you know, we build mosques, whatever. But Christ actually was Immaculate Conception. Hotai maintains that by not fixing anywhere. So his itinerant, moving around, wandering monk is a demonstration of that, not being fixed anywhere. So then what does it mean when he puts down all of his concepts, puts down his bag full of things, and then he says, well, what is the actual, the guy asks him, what is the actualization of them? And he picks up the bag and continues on his way. So it doesn't mean, we often think it means, oh, passivity, we don't take any action, we don't do anything, we let things be as they are. We withdraw from society, we become a hermit in the mountains, we disappear into a monastery, we become someone who no longer, maybe no longer suffers, but no longer loves, all of these ideas, you know. And Hotai is saying, no, I put it down, but because I put it down, I can pick it up. Now I can pick it up and I can go into the world and I can respond with all of these tools I have. I can respond with everything in the universe. You know, his bag holds the universe, actually. That's what it means to actualize. It's to put into practice whatever you experience in your sitting, in your meditation practice, in your spiritual path, you bring into the world. You know, we say Hotai, sometimes we say he enters the marketplace with open, helping hands. So he has this huge bag of stuff and he enters the marketplace and he responds. He doesn't just have a screwdriver. He put down the idea of a screwdriver. I'm taking that one from Bernie, but it applies, right? So what does that mean for us tomorrow? So for 2 days, we've put down our bag. Maybe we've even forgotten what was in the bag. And just settled here, not bothering about the bag, just settled here. And then we will stand up and we will take the bag. And we literally do have our bags that we brought with us, right? That we put all of our life in to come here. And then we pack that bag up and we go out. But we're not the same as when we arrived. You maybe don't realize that, but you're not the same. Everything that you've experienced here is being put into that bag again. Anew, let's say. The stuff you brought, but the stuff you brought has changed as well. It's all dirty now. All the clothes you were wearing are dirty. You have to bring home a bag of dirty clothes and wash it. That's to respond to the situation. So you pick up your bag and then you respond. You have to, maybe it's not dirty, maybe you just will put some of it is okay, you can put it away. maybe you brought things that will stay here, that you finished your toothpaste and you will leave it here. Or maybe someone forgot their toothpaste, and so you will bring something that you didn't bring with you. Maybe you caught a cold here, and you will take that with you. Maybe you came here with a cold and you're feeling okay now. Let's cross our fingers, nobody brought COVID, and we ended up with COVID. But we took tests in our car on the way here, so we didn't bring COVID. The four people in the same car. Can we, like Hotai, go out, and this joins Bernie Glassman's three tenets, which are to not know. So we have this bag, we don't know what's in it. As soon as we start knowing what's in there, then we're eliminating things. Okay, well, yes, there's a screwdriver, and there's a hammer, and there's a feather, but there's not a glass, there's not water, there's not a telephone, there's not a computer, there's not a candle, you know, we can eliminate everything we don't have in there. Whereas if we don't know, we don't know what's in that bag. We don't know. We don't know. And it can be uncomfortable not knowing. We have a better chance of then coming to the situation as Bernie's second point is of bearing witness, which means just being here with the situation, just as a witness would be, just being here with it. And because we don't have a fixed idea, we can then be open to whatever it is. So I had a list when I arrived here. Everybody told me, you know, several times they gave me the list, and then they updated it, who canceled, who was arriving when, all of this stuff. Okay, it was useful, that list, but then I put it away and just sat in the circle with you all the first night and said, okay, let's meet. I wasn't going down the list calling on people or trying to, you know, saying, okay, who is, well, Krisha wasn't here, so I couldn't say who's Krisha. No one would have raised their hand. Right? Who is Adriana? You know, I didn't, like, you know, do this. It was like, I don't know who you are. Tell us who you are. Let's meet, right? We put down the bag of everything that's in there and put down a piece of paper. Okay, let's meet. Same for all of you. You know, many of you didn't know anybody here. And the people who did know each other didn't know the people who were here for the first time. So we all came, we were all here for the first time in a sense. Because it's different people, different day, different light, different temperature, different clothing, everything's different. It's the first time. Can we come to the moment like that? Suzuki Roshi called this beginner's mind. Saying that, you know, in the expert's mind, so somebody who knows exactly what's in the bag and exactly what they need in every situation, there's really very little, it's very limited, the expert's mind. Very limited. The beginner's mind, anything's possible. That's why, in a sense, I envy all of you who are here for the first time. Because anything's possible. You know, you're having this new experience. Maybe there's stuff you don't like, maybe there's stuff you like, maybe you're neutral, whatever, but it's a new experience. Whereas, you know, some of us have been coming here since 2009 or 10, was it? Do you remember, Elizabeth?
2009.
2009, yeah.
November.
What?
November.
Yeah, November, yeah. So we've been here a lot. And yet, it's different. It's new, again. I think the first time I came, I sat there, and the author was there. Because I wanted to look out the windows. But then I had to let go of that because we decided this would be more appropriate this way. So it's always new. So can we forget everything we knew, you know, not knowing, I don't know, all my concepts, immaculate conception, and arrive at the moment, see what arises, and then, like Hotai, pick up my bag, see what's in there, in order to respond to the situation. That's Bernie Glassman's third point, is to take action, appropriate action, to respond to the situation. And that's all we really need to do in our lives. It sounds kind of simplistic, but it's very difficult. Because that first step of not knowing is a challenge. We really want to know. We want to know, is this going to end, what I'm experiencing now, if I don't like it? Or is this going to end? I don't want it to end. We want to know, and we seek the answers elsewhere instead of in ourselves. We have, and then within ourselves, if we look within ourselves, we have this bag of tools that we're used to using, like me just leaving instead of saying goodbye. Deeply entrenched with, you know, fixed ideas about not wanting to resolve, not wanting to feel the pain of separation, right? Not wanting to feel my pain, but also not wanting to see the other's pain. And usually it was like I was leaving my family in America and I wasn't going to see them for a year, you know, so. But it wasn't only that, it could be anything. It could have been leaving my workplace at night, anything. And when we put that bag down and let go of the ideas and the concepts, big relief, actually. There is a real sense of relief. Not having to hold on to that anymore. Not having to be someone smart who knows everything, or not being able to, not having to be the person who never knows anything. Who doesn't know how to solve situations. I once had Christmas years and years, you know, probably 30 years ago with some friends of my husband's, who I didn't know this guy very well. And in France, you always have oysters on Christmas. That's the big main, a lot of other stuff too, but it's traditional to have oysters. And this friend of my husband said, oh, I don't know how to open oysters. You know, he's really convinced he could not open oysters. And it is kind of tricky, but my husband said, come on, yeah, you do it. Oh, no, I don't know how to do it. And then he wasn't going to help my husband, and there were a lot of oysters to open, and my husband was going to do it by himself. And so he convinced his friend. He said, I'll show you how to do it. And he showed him how to do it. Suddenly, he realized he knew how to open oysters. But he had to put down that idea, I don't know how to open oysters. So it's not only, I'm this great guy who can open all these oysters, it can also be, I don't know how to do it, and I'm worthless, and I can't help. And both are just a flip side of the same attachment to self, to an idea about who we are. Hotai is saying, put that down. Put it down. Everything's going to be okay. Put it down. See what's there. And then you will realize that you do have the tools. You do have everything you need. The universe will provide you with everything you need. Absolutely. Not what you think you need. Not what everyone is telling you you need. You know, you know, all those advertisements are telling you you need a new car, a hybrid Mercedes, that you can lease for 500 euros a month and then change in 2 years. You don't need that, you know? You don't. And the universe won't provide you with that. So Hotai gives us a really clear example of what it is. So we come here, we put it down, and then we take the bag and continue on our way. Pick up our bag, continue on our way. And that's a metaphor for life. You know, and I think of João in the kitchen, so he Elizabeth, you know, they have some ideas about what they're going to do, but ultimately, you know, I said, Jamal, how's it going this morning? He said, you know, okay, it was a little late. There's something happened with the fruit. I don't know exactly what happened, but we didn't have all the fruit we thought or something. So he responds to the situation. They responded, and we had breakfast. Seemed fine. So in the kitchen, we have to do that. You come in here and you sit on your cushion and you have no idea what's going to happen in that next half an hour. You really don't. There's this great anticipation where there's going to be a Dharma talk and something's going to happen. We really like the moment of the Dharma talk, except maybe the teacher who doesn't so much like the moment of the Dharma talk. That's not entirely true, but it's different to receive a Dharma talk than to give one. I too, though, come with not knowing. And I was trained in the difficult path of that from my teacher, who was trained by her teacher, who was trained by his teacher, to not prepare. No, you know, some sanghas, some teachers write out their Dharma talk and more or less read it. Well, in my lineage, we were trained not to do that. Super training. Really, really good training to respond to the moment, to wait and see what comes up. Now, of course, I do think before the Dharma talk, okay, what's happening today? So I look at the situation. This is the last day, so what might be appropriate for the last day? What is it that's most important at this moment to share? What comes up for me around that? You know, and then I may, like, you know, in the half hour before, sit a little bit with all of that. And I wrote down the koan. But that's the extent of it. And then I wait and see. Maybe I wouldn't have even taken that out of my pocket. Something else may have come up. You know, I don't know. I don't know. And you don't know either. So you don't know what I'm going to say. You might have this idea that we're going to continue what we talked about yesterday. Well, we are continuing, but it's always a continuation of what we talked about yesterday. different words, different examples, different moment, different, but it's the same. So I think I will let you ask questions, that share whatever comes up for you. It can be about yesterday too. I didn't ask you if you had questions about what we said yesterday, if something has come up. So if anyone would like to offer something or ask a question.
So just thinking the idea of bloom and luminescence. I think I shared with my flower. Great movie, this documentary from this Lama. Did you see it?
Mingyur Rinpoche.
It's the guy that leaves everything.
Yeah, it's Mingyur. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the documentary is called Wandering But Not Lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you have seen it. If you can share, I don't have WhatsApp. Because that is a very extreme. You
Absolutely.
Really want to confront the world as it is. So he was used to live under this whole kinds of rituals, of course, very familiar, very, I would say, worship even, like a half god. And, I better not spoil.
he's
a very extreme case.
Yeah.
Someone that really goes into the wilderness without knowing anything and really testing his teachings, his knowledge, his wisdom, in the most difficult situations, without presenting himself, of course, as a lama, as a spiritual.
He lets go of even that.
He lets go of everything. He almost dies. Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't tell.
He's wandering but not lost.
He's the same one that I mentioned yesterday. Did I mention it?
Is it the in love with the world?
Yes, it is. It's in love
with
the world, yeah. Who was it here that I mentioned?
No.
This is wandering, but not lost.
Right, but it's based on his book, In Love with the World.
Yeah.
Because the cameras couldn't possibly have been with him for 4.5 years. So they took the book and had him, like, go to the places he had been and talk about it and talk with other people in the documentary.
But the email, the address that was sent, is not opening.
It's not valid anymore. It's too old. Yeah. I found it by a different way, but
you can share it?
Well, it's not valid anymore either. It was only good for 4 days, the one I had.
Oh.
I'm sure somebody can find it somewhere. But
okay.
Or read the book. The book is absolutely beautiful. It's the same story, but it's the book came out first. He did this book first. So it wasn't here that I mentioned it. No.
Sorry.
That's right. I'm sorry. Because in the book, not in the film, but in the book, he tells a story when he was 12 years old, and his father was this great lama, a great teacher, famous Tibetan teacher. And every day he would go have lunch with his father, and when he was 12 years old, and of course they were served. I mean, he tells in the book and in the film, at the age of whatever age he was, 35 or something when he does this, he had never even bought a train ticket for himself. He'd never done anything for himself, right? So they're served lunch and everything. So he would go and see his father, and they would wait to be served, and they would meditate or something while they were waiting. And this boy had grown up in a monastery. No, not a monastery. Well, maybe a monastery. I don't know. His father was not a monk, but and had all these great teachings and the basic thing of staying in the essential nature of mind. That was the goal, right? Like we always say, be present here now, something like that. See the true nature of things. So that was the basic teaching. And so he really wanted to show his father that he got it and he was good at it. So he went and had lunch with his father, and while they were waiting, he sat like beautifully, perfectly, like he thought you should sit, representing, resting calmly in the true nature of mind. Really wanted his father to see this, you know. And his father said, what are you doing? And he said, Father, I'm staying calmly in the true nature of mind, or something like that. And his father said, son, it's fake. It's all fake. All the teachings, all of that phrase, all of the robes, all of the rituals, it's all fake. So when we hear that, and that was a really important moment for him as a 12-year-old boy to hear that from his father, this great master, right? And so when you hear that, you're not surprised that he did what he did 25 years later. He threw it all away. He put it all down. He put it down and went out into the world. Right? His way of putting it down was to go out and wander. But when you hear that story of when he was 12, you think, aha, that seed was already planted. Somewhere he knew that it wasn't this. It's like yesterday. It's not about the chairs. Mm-hmm. He knew. His father was telling him, it's not about the chairs, my son. And he could see that his son was stuck on the chairs, showing how beautifully he could stay in the natural order of mind. When that wasn't at all what being in the natural order of mind was about. So yeah, if you can find that link somewhere, like Marlene, I tried it and I couldn't find it.
But
the book is great.
I keep on to see what's in the internet. And it's, as you are saying, he has in YouTube many things, and where the teachings are presented very formally, Nandro things, preparations, so many things. And then he gives also, I found one, it's the monkey mind. You just put monkey mind and it appears, and in 5-10 minutes you see it. You just see it, and it's a joke. It's really precious, monkey mind.
This is around Mingyur, or no?
Yeah.
He's a really wonderful
teacher.
He's
very practical too.
Yeah,
wow.
Very teacher. Yeah.
I have a question actually, not a comment. That's new, right? I'm happy with that. So my question is, when do we know that we've rested with the bag time enough, that we've given the bag enough time, that now we should get the bag again and go and act? What is the moment that tells us that we should go from contemplation to action?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Great. Is it on a textbook somewhere?
Yeah.
Can I see it?
Yeah, there is no fixed, again, even that is not fixed, we don't know. You do the best you can, it's never enough, and at the same time, it's always enough. Like, again, like I'm referring to Bernie Glassman, because this is very much around his teachings, he used to say, you know, if you wait until you are enlightened to take some action in the world, well, you'll never do anything. If you think that you have to be the one who solves the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, forget about it. You know, forget it. You will never do anything. But he said, and I've said this before, he said, you can see if your neighbor is sick and needs groceries. Or you can clean the toilet so that your partner doesn't have to do it. Or come to a meditation retreat and offer this to yourself. You know, it's really, you don't have to do some, be some perfect, arrive at some perfect space. The bag can be put down at any moment and just see what arises. And then you can pick it up again, right? The example Bernie often would give was, if you're walking down the street and busy, tiny little street in Lisbon, and there's, you know, a steep hill and it's wet, and, you know, on those little stones that are slippery, and some boys are playing football and they kick the ball into the street, and a boy running into the street to get the ball, and there's a car coming really fast, or a tramway or something. Would you say, I'm not equipped for that. I don't have the right shoes. What will people think of me if I run into the street? You're not supposed to cross the street there. Those parents that let their kids play in the street, that's just inexcusable. That taxi driver, he should drive more slowly. Wait, what kind of football is that? Oh, that's the one from the World Cup. None of that. And that's usually what we're involved with when we decide what we should do or not do. You just pull the kid back so that he doesn't get run over by the tramway or the taxi or whatever it is. And then after, you might say, be careful, or something. Or you might say, ooh, that was close. Or you might say, wait, and I'll help you get the ball back. I don't know. It sounds like a really silly example, but that's the kind of thing that arises every single moment. We're worried about the shoes. We're worried about the chairs, once again, you know. Is that the right kind of chair? I might fall. These are slippery. Well, you might, but the kid will die probably if he gets hit by the car. You know? So we, yeah, sorry, that's the good news, but also that's the bad news, but also the good news. Yeah. You're always equipped. And you can always put it down and you can always pick it up.
Can I say something?
Mm-hmm.
Would like to comment about the Immaculate Conception that you gave. I just want to say that never before, someone from a Catholic point of view have explained that in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was very nice.
Thank you. I doubt that it would be explained. Well, you know, there might be some Catholic mystics that might, you know, address it that way. I don't know, but the doctrine of the Church would not. No. Yeah. And again, it's Alan Watts who said that. But it spoke to me so much that I just love it, and I always...
He was practically Catholic.
What?
He was practically Catholic.
He was Episcopalian, yeah.
Episcopalian.
Absolutely, yeah. He was Christian, you know, deeply Christian. Even a, you know, not a priest.
He was a priest.
Yeah, he was a priest, Episcopalian priest, yeah.
Yeah.
So he had a direct connection with the Immaculate Conception.
Because I think if they explained it in that way, it would be much easier to understand it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. However, though, then that would take away all of the mythology around Mary, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And Mary's connection to God, and then the mother that the church has erected. You know, so it would change a lot. That's true. And I was not raised Catholic, so I can't. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot about it. Living in France, very Catholic. Yeah.
I have this question that keeps coming. I mean, in theory, I know the answer, but like in practical terms, it's harder. So you mentioned about the putting the bag down and then taking it back and responding to life. And I remember one talk with you about the absolute and the relative and the right amount, you know, all these things. So my question is, I know that in theory we need both, but what I feel sometimes in my experience is that the relative, the world sometimes demands a lot, too much, and I just can't keep putting the bag down. I get lost again in self, and I go back to the same place where I realize it, and then I go back to the world, and after a while, here I am again, not putting the bag down, you know, and I'm constantly in these circles, and that makes me wonder if I could, like, as a metaphor, go to a monastery or just be away from everything, like for a long period. Would then I be more prepared to face, or maybe it would be easier to face everything? Because yes, you can do both, because you know it's about your presence. But sometimes I just can't. Mm. It's too much for me.
Yeah.
Or I don't have enough. Practice or awareness or whatever it is, but I find it really difficult to keep that balance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think everybody can probably identify with this in their own way, you know, to different degrees. It is a challenge. It really is, you know, to go out there. Shogyam Trungpa used to say, what we're trying to do, he was a Tibetan master, what we're trying to do in the West, this path of awakening and putting down the bag, he wouldn't say that, but that, compared to what they do in Tibetan or Chinese or Japanese monasteries, is really much more difficult than what they're trying to do in monasteries, right? So it is a huge challenge. He said it's like trying to sit meditation and be clear and wake up in the middle of the Los Angeles freeway, which is like,
exactly.
The Los Angeles freeway is just, you can't even believe it. Okay, that's where we are. That's our situation. So what do we do? Can we put down this idea that we should have a different situation? It would be easier somewhere else. This is so hard, you know, all of this. Which it is, I'm not denying that it is. But part of the reason that it becomes harder is because we're hanging on to it. You know, this idea of it, of what we want to achieve. So maybe can we look at it like, it doesn't have to be, like Bernie said, it doesn't have to be big stuff. So it can just be returning, you know, in a moment during the day when you remember and say, oh yeah, I really wanted to put stuff down now. And already when you do that, you're putting something down. And you can use reminders, you know, like, you know, wear a mala or set an alarm on your clock or post it on your computer or something, you know. The best thing for any kind of training is regularity, so it's best to have like a regular meditation practice, even if it's 10 minutes, you know, 10 minutes three times a week or something. It's that regularity that helps us to, you know, as you know, like with your foot. So the last time you were here, your foot got really messed up. And then over time, it heals, but it took time, and probably, I don't know, did you have physical therapy or something? Or
no, just rest.
Just rest, okay, yeah. So it takes time. It took regular rest, however you want to identify that. Same with anything, any discipline, anything we do, it requires regularity, practice, and having some compassion for yourself to say, it's okay if I have a hard time with this. It's okay. The guy, Adi Ashanti, I told that recently to someone, I forget who I was, in a talk somewhere. I've given these so many talks in the past month that I forgot, but Adi Ashanti, who was this great American teacher who I had never listened to before. I've heard people talk about him. Thomas has talked to me about Adi Ashanti for years. He listens to Adi Ashanti all the time, and I never listened to him. But I heard this interview with him when he tells his story of how he got to be this teacher that he is. And he had been a professional athlete, professional bike racer, high-level athlete. So he had this, you know, really strong iron discipline of riding, bike training, and he was convinced that in his sport, that's the people who trained the most and did the hardest work were the ones who succeeded, and I'm assuming he had some success, I don't know. So when he discovered meditation, he did the same thing. He applied the same technique, just like fanatic meditation. Yeah, and even his teachers would say, whoa, you know, cool it, you know, give it a break. You don't have to do that. But he was like, no. And he did this for 3 years. And then one day, he was living with his parents. He was a young guy working in a bike shop, so he probably didn't have a lot of money. And he had this little hut that he built in the garden, and it was a meditation hut, and he went out there and he sat down and he said, you know, can't do this. I just can't, you know, it's just like, this is not getting anywhere. It's just too much effort, and I forget how he phrased it, but that was it. It was like, you know, this incredible, ferocious discipline about meditation and all this, and his teachers were saying, don't do it like that, but he said, I just can't do it. He put it down, and at that moment, sky opened, or whatever, I forget how he describes it, but everything changed. But he really put in a lot of effort. I'm not, but it's kind of the equivalent of what you're saying, of we're just like so caught up in our thing, so caught up in our lives, and then we have, in the corner of our head, we have this idea, oh, I should put it down, or however we phrase it, or even we forgot. But at some moment, if you can put down the idea even that you should put it down, something changes. Then it's just what it is. You're not clinging to it anymore. It's difficult. You're still caught up in your daily stuff, but not in the same way. Because you're not thinking, you're not clinging to it in the same way. I should put this down, I should not do this, I should not. It's okay. You can wake up in the middle of the Los Angeles freeway. You can wake up in the middle of wherever you are. If you just put down the ideas, you know, come back to the Immaculate Conception, put down the concepts about it. This is not it, I shouldn't be this, this, whatever. On the other hand, I absolutely know what you're talking about, Sophia, and I think everybody does. So.
And do you think it can, if you can, adapt into each one's circumstances, but withdraw, like take time.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Absolutely. There's moments for that. That's what we do. We come here for a weekend. We go to a week-long retreat. We go to somewhere where they have longer retreats. That's why I came to Lisbon for a month, to Portugal for the month. Of course, I had stuff I had to do, but it was also, I'm pulling out. gone out. You know, I had just the most insane 9 months, really caught up in all of everything in my life. And, okay, I'll put it down and I'll come to Lisbon.
There is this very famous classic book by Gallagher about, you know, shooting, the heart of shooting to the target.
Zen and the,
yeah,
and the Art of Archery.
The Archery.
Yeah. Now that is exactly the same teaching. The guy was really stuck at this idea that he had really to make it as perfect as possible. And the only he was able to do it with the drops as. Yeah. It was a very famous book in the 50s. Many people start practicing that.
Yeah, for a long time it was one of the only books you could get.
But the basic teaching is that one.
Absolutely. Put it down.
Koshi, do you still have time?
I don't know.
Well, 1:26.
Okay, so.
We have?
Go ahead, yeah.
About yesterday, something is puzzling me, but I'm not sure if I. But I would like some help in clarifying what is puzzling me or an answer. Yesterday, you somewhere in your talk were saying about perhaps we have to love ourselves. And I'm not remembering the context, but something about, I don't know, stop looking from outside, perhaps, and love ourselves. And it came to me, well, but if there's no self, how can we do it? And this is what is puzzling me. And I remember we had a study group, but I don't remember the concept, the words, but it was the flower, Tikatan, as the absolutely absence of self that exists. But, you know, it's about the caring of someone watering or the nature raining and the earth and everything about her existence, her power or our existence, it's absence of self in the sense that we are, I don't remember the word.
Interdependent.
Thank you.
What? We are absolutely what?
Interdependent.
Ah.
But it was not that the text was saying. It was really clear and really sweet as Thich Nhat Hanh usually is. Remember, don't be afraid of not exist, but because you absolutely exist, you're just absence of self in the sense that you are kind of a product of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, what is supposed for us to do when thinking about loving ourselves?
Well, I feel like you just said it, didn't you?
Did I? But I didn't grasp it.
So when you see that you are not separate from the flower and you care. I don't remember that text. That's funny. I don't remember that text
it's,
in the study
group. It's Thich Nhat Hanh. It has three stuff, but I'm really bad
at it. Anyway, so when you see that you are the flower, when the flower is you, when all is one,
okay.
You're in love with the world. Like Ming Yur says, no? So I'm not.
Yeah. You are almost, but I feel like I can't see it.
Okay,
it's
well
stupid.
Then you keep looking at it though. Keep looking.
I feel I grasp it, but then it goes away.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And is that what you mean you already are? What you are looking for?
That's true, yeah. Yeah, that's true. You are already what you're looking for. But we don't see it, and therefore we don't love ourselves. And we don't love others because we don't realize that. What?
Did you guys love?
Exactly, yeah. It's my Dharma name. Yeah. That's right. You are that. Good way to end.
Thank you.
do the four bells. Yeah.
Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to see it. The other way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Sentient beings are.